This reading comes from the New Testament, the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 25. In this familiar passage, Jesus of Nazareth says that on the day of judgment, God's measure of the nations will be compassion and righteousness. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on the right and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance. The kingdom has prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you invited me to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you? Or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger, invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did for the one of the least, who are my kindred, you did for me." Then he will say to those on his left, "Depart from me. You are cursed into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me." They will also answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick and in prison and did not help you?" He will reply, "I tell you the truth. Whatever you did not do for one of the least, who are my kindred, you did not do for me."
Please remain seated and join us in this new song by UU musician Judy Fiel.
We are holding the soul of Martin in our own two hands. We are holding the soul of Martin in our hands. Though injustice surrounds us, may love prevail. We are holding the soul of Martin in our hands. We are holding peace and justice in our own two hands. We are holding peace and justice in our hands. Though injustice surrounds us, may love prevail. We are holding peace and justice in our hands. We are holding the poor and hurting in our hearts today. We are holding the poor and hurting in our Martin in our own two hands. We are holding the work of Martin in our hands. Though injustice surrounds us. May love prevail. We are holding the work of Martin in our hands.
The Unitarian minister James Luther Adams, one of our great activists and seminary professors of the mid-20th century, told the story of a man who came to him for pastoral counseling back in the 1930s. Caught in a vice of the global economic depression and feeling shame as well as despair, the man had tried to kill himself, but hadn't been successful. "Why shouldn't I have done it?" he asked the minister. "My family would have had money from the insurance policy." Adams heard the man's pain and worry. In response, he affirmed his worth and assured him of God's care and love. Yet Adams went on to offer a social analysis. He described how the rapid economic expansion of the 1920s had lacked any sense of caution or legal safeguards. The financial bubble had been fueled by lies, denial, greed, and false hopes. He showed this man that he was not alone in his experience or in his feelings. Indeed, after that bubble burst, many people were newly poor and hurting. The pastor's insights about our system didn't help the guy find work, but they reduced his isolation and shame. A social analysis can give rise to a sense of solidarity, and solidarity can generate courage and hope. Without a social analysis, without solidarity, too many people feel they are alone in their suffering and powerless to change it. I think of the women who have been hurt by unwelcome advances or groping from supervisors or harassment by male colleagues, feeling trapped in a system of sexualized violence. Against the system and against the culture of patriarchy, the recent Me Too movement is a sign of solidarity and courage. I think of the young men of color who can recount being stopped nearly on a regular basis in their cars by law enforcement officers, or the parents lecturing their sons with black or brown skin on what to do to avoid provoking a police officer if stopped, or the family grieving the death of a son who was killed even though he was unarmed. The emergence of Black Lives Matter is an example of solidarity generated by a social analysis. It is an affirmation of Black humanity within a social and economic system built on a system of racist hierarchy. I think of the 40 million very poor people who live in desperation and pain and hunger in this country. How many of them need a social analysis to avoid the shame that can burden the soul when you have to choose between paying the light bill and rent or feeding your children and buying them shoes as their feet grow or the temperature falls in the winter? With his eloquent oratory and prose, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. applied a social analysis and a moral analysis to this country and our cities, not only regarding racist depression and unequal treatment, but also applied to the grinding forces of poverty. This is what led him to promote the Poor People's Campaign in 1967 and 68. Dr. King's aim for that campaign was to build on the solidarity developed in the civil rights movement. And now he was promoting human rights, economic rights like fair pay, access to a stable income, and a decent education. He envisioned linking together all kinds of people to demand fairness and justice. This included poor white people from farm states and coal mining communities, and African Americans from segregated cities in the North as well as in the South.
He said, "I'm not only concerned about the black poor, I'm concerned about the white poor. I'm concerned about the Puerto Rican poor, the Indian poor, the Mexican American poor. We are going to grapple with the problem of poor people." The plan was to mobilize tens of thousands to protest peaceably in Washington, D.C., and thereby throw a wrench in the machinery of government. By stopping government with protest, with civil disobedience, Dr. King wanted to force the country to address poverty and stop the costly and wasteful war machine. Several factors made his vision slow to realize. It was just a few years after President Lyndon Johnson had supported and signed civil rights legislation. President Johnson took Dr. King's public opposition to the ongoing U.S. war in Vietnam as a great betrayal. And government spying on Dr. King intensified. The FBI, Army intelligence, and local police departments spied on him and on other civil rights leaders around the country. Governments and right-wing organizations waged misinformation campaigns to undermine the public support of civil rights leaders. The civil rights leaders near Dr. King were torn by arguments over goals and strategies. Moreover, most of his colleagues were black male ministers, educated and middle class. Organizing poor whites or Spanish-speaking migrant workers was beyond their ability or expertise. In 1968, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee to support city sanitation workers as they organized a union and helped workers in demanding fair treatment. During this journey to Memphis, he was gunned down outside a motel 10 days before Easter. Much of this past half century, the half century that followed the activism of the 60s and 70s, and 50s and 60s and 70s can be seen as an era of racist backlash in politics. And the result is a loss of economic progress or stability for ordinary workers. And here is how things look today. One of the richest nations in the world ever, this country spends more on the military than China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and several other countries combined. Yet one person out of every 8 U.S. Americans lives in poverty. And many of our hungry, sick, and poor people are children. United Nations monitor Philip Alston says this: "If you want to talk about the American dream, statistically, a child born into poverty has almost no chance of getting out of poverty in today's United States." This is a moral issue. Last year, in his role as the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Extreme Poverty, Philip Alston conducted a fact-finding mission, not in a poor country, but in this country. In California, Georgia, Alabama, Washington, D.C., Puerto Rico, and West Virginia, he found the results of growing economic inequality. The results look like this: rotting teeth, crushing debt, homelessness, hunger, drug addiction, untreated illnesses, and pollution. He writes, "Americans can expect to live shorter and sicker lives compared to people living in any other rich democracy." This is a moral issue. Many people think of morality as an individual question, yet morality also has to do with how communities treat people. Do communities support human flourishing or provoke human suffering? Do we ignore the needs of the vulnerable? The passage we heard read from the Gospel of Matthew imagines the Day of Judgment as a time when God would separate the sheep from the goats, the saved from the damned, In this passage, the measure of our souls will not be religious belief. Not be religious belief, not baptism, not even church going. The measure will be righteousness, justice, and compassion. Jesus tells them, "I was hungry and you gave me no food. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger and you did not welcome me, naked and you did not give me clothing, sick and in prison and you did not visit me." He says, "As surely as you hurt the least of these, you hurt me." All the times when I've heard that famous passage, I never heard or noticed one key word in it till now. Nations. Maybe I just overlooked it. When sorting the sheep from the goats, sorting the humble souls from the selfish ones, God will judge the nations. God won't merely measure the compassion or mercy of individuals, but of how we act as nations. Whole nations will be judged by how we treat the hurting and the vulnerable. Widespread poverty in a nation of plenty is a moral issue. Speaking of morality, you may be smarting still from last week's news story. You may be disheartened, like me, by the public vulgarity of our current president, Donald Trump, in referring to immigrants from particular non-white nations. One more example of one man's lack of morality, compassion, or decency, which makes obvious the lack of morality, compassion, or decency of the current national agenda. Yet the Reverend William J. Barber II says it is a mistake to focus all our energy on Donald Trump. The immoral systems that weigh down on the least of these have been in the works for a long time. Injustice and oppression were on the march well before the 2016 election. William Barber is a progressive Protestant minister and head of North Carolina's NAACP. In that state, he launched the Moral Mondays campaign. Every week, mass demonstrations and civil disobedience protests brought attention to and pressure against state laws that would hurt public schools and basic health care, and laws designed to undermine democracy, especially by suppressing voter turnout in black and poor communities. Barber is an energetic and eloquent public speaker. 2 months ago, some of us from here heard his lecture in Sacramento at St. Mark's United Methodist Church. He has spoken at Unitarian Universalist events, and he will preach at our denomination's regional assembly in Portland, Oregon, and that will take place the last weekend of April. Currently, Barber is promoting the new Poor People's Campaign. The campaign will raise issues and put pressure on politicians in what is framed as 40 days of action. Starting on Mother's Day and going through the first day of summer, June 21, a series of protests and prayer vigils and nonviolent civil disobedience will take place in 25 states. The goal is to use that window of time to advance a moral agenda for public policy. The goal is to get politicians and the media to pay attention to the moral crisis of this nation. When we pay attention to tweets and vulgarity and see only immoral personalities, we don't see immoral policies as clearly. For example, Barber points out, in the general and primary presidential election campaign of 2016, we had 26 debates, but not 1 hour of them was on poverty or the war economy or ecological devastation. Why not? Because nothing forced it, he says, people of good faith must force the issue. Reverend Barber places current events in a sweep of racist history going back to the end of the American Civil War. And from this perspective, he sees the many setbacks in the work toward treating poor people fairly as the result of a political backlash. The backlash works this way. After some progress, politicians promote racialized policies and campaigns to gain traction among resentful white voters, some of whom are selfish or uncaring, and many of whom are fearful and hurting. Racialized political tactics hide this nation's growing economic inequality. And this is the case in spite of the fact that immoral policies hurt more than just people of color. Barber notes that there are many more poor whites than blacks in this country. If you're black, if you're white, if you're brown, and you can't make enough to pay the light bill, there's little difference, Barber says. We're all black in the dark. Though our system is founded on white supremacy, the system crushes more whites than people of color. Barber says America has never wanted to talk about race except with regard to interpersonal relationships and what's in our heart. But I'm not a heart surgeon, he says. I don't want to see what's in your heart. I want to look at the heart of your policies. And what we can see on matters of immigration, a living wage, affordable housing, access to health care, public school funding, and the proliferation of guns, what we can see are policies that are heartless. 1/3 of our population is crippled by poverty, he says. We can buy unleaded gasoline, but children in poor communities can't consume unleaded water from their taps, Barber says, noting the toxic water in the pipes of Flint, Michigan. And we might add the undrinkable water of some farm worker villages in Central California. Suppression of African American voters is on the rise in many states. Yet he says it's important to see that voter suppression and other attacks on democratic participation happen in places where poor people live. Furthermore, in places where the earth is harmed, poor suffer the worst. It was for wealth and power that political strategies have generated and manipulated racial resentment. Systemic racism, he says, is not about the dislike of people who aren't white. He says it's about the dislike of democracy. Winning strategies may traffic in resentments against immigrants and people of color, yet the result is policies that hurt all people and policies that endanger all of our democracy. He says racism isn't about whether you use a slur or not, or have a black friend or not. It's about power and policy. Systemic racism is about power and policy. So what can we do? If we wish to achieve a moral society or move toward a moral society, what can we do? One is to realize that the work is always continuing, yet it doesn't always look the way it used to. One example is that in the 1950s and 60s, it was mostly black men of prominence who led civil rights campaigns and ran the organizations of the civil rights movement. With few notable exceptions, women were kept on the margins of leadership structures. In our day, organizations like Black Lives Matter are led by women of color. Community organizing efforts by poor people are led by poor people and by young people, including many who identify across the spectrum of gender and sexual identity. This is a welcome change, and who knows what more changes will emerge as we try to achieve a moral society. Another way to work toward a moral society is to learn from the leadership of people in vulnerable populations and to follow their leadership. We can show up when they show up, when they show courage and creativity, like the people who are our leaders in Sacramento Black Lives Matter. They seek our solidarity in their alternative march tomorrow morning for Martin Luther King Day. We can show up for the Women's March next Saturday or otherwise support it. We can support local efforts to ease hunger and to organize communities. A great example comes from the volunteer leaders among the low-wage domestic workers in the Western Service Workers Association. They are creative problem solvers. In less than a year in our relationship with them, I have learned from them how precarious is life in poverty and how creative are people who live in poverty and work for poverty wages. I have learned from their social analysis and their creativity. Solidarity builds hope and courage. In every local community, there are ways to draw attention to poverty and to work to relieve it. We can learn from the leaders who put their lives into the work. Learn from the leaders who feel directly the force of an unjust social system. Dr. King's legacy is the vision of equality, which he articulated. The legacy includes the social progress brought about by his leadership. It came about also from the courage of thousands of Black adults and youth and children in the civil rights movement and the solidarity of others who listened for the moral call of their conscience. His legacy includes the hard work of building a land where morality means food for the hungry, health care for the hurting, safety for our kindred of all genders, a chance for children to thrive, and enough money to survive. So may we live, and so may it be. Blessed be, and amen.